him out, so that he could vent that way instead of the other. "Use your words," I used to say when he was little, and most of the time he did. But once, walking away from St. Stanley's in the morning, I'd heard a group of boys calling him Robert the Hobbit, of all things, no more than a silly sing-song following him down the street, Robert the Hobbit, Robert the Hobbit, as he trudged along the pavement with his head down. And then, almost without breaking stride, he'd turned and hurled himself at them, his arms pinwheeling, his eyes big. "Shut up!" he shrieked as he hit and hit and hit, the other boys stunned, backing away, putting their hands up, palms out. "Shut up!" Until I pulled him away, screaming myself, "For God's sake, Robert, stop it, stop it!" "Daddy said you have to fight back," he'd said as I hectored him on the way home. And when I complained, Bobby just waved his hand and shrugged. "The trouble is, Fran, that you don't know about boys," he'd said. Moving away from me down the long market aisle, Robert looked just as Bobby might have as a boy, except that there was something defenseless in the way he held himself, a kind of roundness to back and shoulder. And I wondered whether Bobby had ever been like that, defenseless, before biceps and bravado and badge, before me. Or whether Robert had learned to walk like that from me, from all the years that I'd made myself small, trying not to attract notice, give offense. Suddenly, as though he'd felt my eyes on his back, Robert looked over his shoulder and smiled. A smile that on that dark, pinched face was more than a smile, was a hand, a hug, a kiss. That was the smile Bobby had had, too, when he saw me when we were both young, that made my spirit levitate, warm from the inside out. "You know what, Frances Ann," Bobby had said, sitting next to my bed in the single room on the hospital's maternity floor, Robert's misshapen little head cupped in his palm. "We got everything." Jesus, I loved him. There, I said it. It makes me feel stupid sometimes, feeling my scars. The spots where you can just make out the damage and the ones where the bruises and hurts live on only in my head. I loved Bobby, and he loved me. Anyone who heard him say it once would never disbelieve it. In the beginning, I loved him, loved him, loved him pure and simple. And then after a while, I loved the idea of him. The good Bobby, who came to me every once in a while and rubbed my back and kissed my fingers. And I loved our life. The long stretches of tedium and small pleasures that marked most of our time together. Our life was like a connect-the-dots drawing, and those were the lines. The bad things only the haphazard arrangement of dots they connected. And now all the love goes into what's left of that life. One boy, his basketball shoes too big for his little body. I watch him, and I'm afraid my face looks the way Ann Benedetto's face looked when she watched Bobby. Like a hungry cat when it hears the can opener, all eyes and appetite. I'm afraid that I'll wind up the way she did. With nothing but the casual, almost charitable, almost condescending affection that a grown man has for his mother once he's moved on to another woman, another source of intensive care. Alone in that spotless house, with the photographs on top of the television, Bobby at 4, his foot tucked under him, his chubby fingers wrapped around his knee. Bobby at 26, in his dress uniform. Across the living room, on the wall unit, was the photograph of her husband in his own police blues. "My old man was some piece of work," Bobby always said. He'd been shot, Robert Sr., by a junkie who didn't know how to wave a gun around during a bar robbery without having the thing go off. It was 2 months after we started going out, and I cried at the funeral, not for Lieutenant Benedetto, who I'd met only once, but for his son. The sound of the bagpipes was like strange birds, and the cops were like an army, blue with black swipes of elastic over their badges. That's all he ever said. Some piece of work. Never an anecdote or a word of affection or even anger. His father was the stone in Bobby's heart. And maybe his own father would be the stone in Robert's. The patterns. The patterns as inviolate as a clan tartan. Red, green, black, blue, father, son. I'd been standing staring into the depths of a half-filled cart, and when I looked up, a tall man had stopped Robert at the end of the aisle and was putting a hand on his shoulder. Suddenly I felt my stomach empty out, felt as though I might faint. I pushed forward, but there were two elderly women crowding the aisles, peering at coupons, and by the time I got past them, Robert wasn't there. The man was looking at chickens, or pretending to. Looking too hard, I thought, like a bad actor, so that he didn't look up until I'd planted myself in front of him. "Excuse me," I said. "What were you saying to that child?"
"What?"
"That boy. The one with the dark hair. What were you saying to him?" I realized the two women with the coupons were looking at me. My voice was too loud, even to myself.
"Robert Crenshaw? I teach him P.E. at the elementary school."
The relief in my posture, the surrender to the safe and commonplace in my shoulders, head, face, must have been so profound that he peered at me, perplexed for a moment, then smiled.
"You're Robert's mother," he said, "and I just scared the heck out of you. I am really, really sorry."
"No, no, forget it. It was silly. It's just
that you have to be more careful today than when we were kids. Hey, in my job, I know."
He stuck out a big hand, thick-fingered. My own disappeared inside it, then reappeared as I pulled away, like a small fish released from the maw of a big one. He was a bigger man than I'd thought, seeing him across the parking lot and lawn of the school that first day, big and bulky, flushed and friendly, with thinning blonde hair and light eyes behind aviator glasses. "What kind of animal does your gym teacher remind you of?" I'd ask Robert walking home, another game we played. And the answer would be something good-natured, plodding, big and big-hearted. A bear, maybe.
"Mike Reardon."
"Beth Crenshaw."
"I know," he said. "You and Mrs. Rohrbacher work in the library."
"Sorry, I missed meeting you somehow."
"I'm a gym rat," he said. "I'm practically mildewed.
You from New York?"
"No," I said, feeling my shoulders tighten again. "Delaware."
"You sound like New York," he said. "I've been meaning to call you about Robert."
"Why?"
"Hey, he's fine. You know, he's new. He'll open up more when he gets used to the drill here. There's no problem. I just want him to play on our soccer team. No big deal, no high pressure. 2 practices a week and they're before dinner time. I never yell and scream, and I give them the day off before a big test. But we start next week, and he'd need to stay after school and either walk home or have you pick him up. He's new, and he didn't seem too sure it would be okay with you. Benny Castro's playing, if that makes a difference."
"I'll talk to him. It's fine. It would be good for him."
"Great. Great."
He paused. "I'll send home a permission slip and some more information. You can call me if you have any questions. I'm the vice principal, too, whatever that means.
Call about anything, the school, the homework, whatever."
He hesitated, looking into his card.
"Would you mind if I asked you something?"
I shook my head.
"How much do you know about chicken?"
"Chicken?"
"Cooking chicken."
"I've cooked a lot of chickens, if that's what you're asking."
"You know those things that you can put inside the chicken, sort of holds them standing up so they cook faster? They've got them back with the pots and pans and things. They're metal, shaped kind of like a big golf tee. Do those things work?"
I laughed.
I don't know, I said. It never occurred to me to buy one. A chicken only takes an hour anyhow. Why rush it?
That's what I thought. Thanks, he said, staring into the meat case.
Suddenly, I heard Gracie's voice, as clear as if it was coming over the loudspeaker instead of John Mac Carter's tips for using exciting, exotic cilantro in a variety of dishes with an international flair.
Where were we sitting, Grace and I? Was it that coffee bar on Lexington Avenue where the counterman always called her professor? Or the Greek restaurant in the village with the homemade pita that made us both so full we would groan all the way to the subway?
The Greek place, I think. And Grace talking about the tall man she kept running into at D'Agostino's, who wanted to know about tarragon, about potatoes, about sour and heavy and light cream.
As though I wouldn't know that asking a woman about how to cook is the oldest pickup line in the book, Grace said, shaking her head.
I didn't know that, I'd said.
When was the last time somebody picked you up? She said.
Almost 20 years ago, I'd said.
Bobby, in the bar where Tommy Dolan had introduced us. Bobby, one black apostrophe of hair over his forehead, saying,
Hey, Fran Flynn, I guess if everybody likes you, I might like you too.
Bobby, leaning against the bar, a perfectly natural pose, his elbows back, his big forearms knotted, his pelvis thrust forward, which was the whole point.
Well, good luck, I said to Mike Reardon, and then felt myself turning hot and red, the same way I'd colored that first time I met Bobby. I felt foolish as I strode off to pick up parsley, tomatoes, and garlic. Soccer season, rules, practices, uniforms. Maybe while Robert was at practice, after I got home from the Levitts, I would do something to his room. Cheap bright curtains and a new quilt, some more posters, a desk. I thought there might have been an old desk in one corner of Cindy's basement. Vermicelli, chicken stock, tomato paste. The cart was getting too full. Robert would complain about the weight of the bag all the way home, particularly if he had a comic he wanted to be reading instead. It was time to check out, head home. A stock boy sent me 7 aisles over to where the comic books shared an aisle with greeting cards and paperbacks. But only one elderly woman was there, reading birthday cards with her face close to their gaudy surfaces. I walked slowly, snaking through aisle after aisle, thinking about how big the market was, bigger than any I'd visited in the city, looking for Robert. Looking and looking, I began weaving through other shoppers, past cans of soup and coffee, cases of Coke and Pepsi, stacks of paper towels and toilet paper, back to the comic aisle, empty now. Part of my mind kept thinking that I needed paper towels, and the other part was saying, shouting, screaming over and over again, Robert, Ba, baby, where are you? I turned in aisle 16, dairy, and made my way back again. Have you seen a boy about 10 in a green T-shirt with a tiger on the front? I began to ask the other shoppers. And no, they said. No, sorry, no, I haven't. Of course they haven't, thought one part of my mind, because he's in a car now, driving down the highway, saying, Hey, Dad, I missed you, Dad. How's Grandmom? Where are we going? When are we going to go back and get Mommy? I was moving so fast that I bumped into someone's cart and knocked a box of cereal from it. I came around the corner in frozen foods and almost collided with a man holding a box of macaroni and cheese, reading the back, and I saw that it was the gym teacher again, but I suddenly couldn't recall his first name, only that he wanted Robert to play soccer, that I needed paper towels, and that my son was gone. He knew right away, as he looked up, saw me, smiled, then frowned, that something was wrong.
I can't find Robert, I said, my voice an octave higher than usual, almost falsetto.
Calm down, he said. Calm down.
He took my arm at the elbow and led me toward the front of the store, leaving our two carts next to the freezer cases, glass and chrome and foggy windows, like the cases in the morgue at the hospital, where we nurses tried never to go if we could help it. I could tell by the feel of his hand at my elbow that he was used to taking charge. "He can't have gone far," he said, like it was something he'd said before. At the window where they cashed checks, he stuck his head inside. "Excuse me," he called, and then I remembered that his name was Mike. A heavy girl with bad skin came over to the window. "Customer service," said the sign over her head.
"I'm on break," she said.
"We've lost a child," Mike Reardon said. "Can you do a page or something? Robert is his name, Robert Crenshaw."
"I can't page without the manager."
"Where's the manager?" She called into the back,
"Where's Lenny?"
And there was a mumbled sound, and then she came out of the booth and I started to cry, my hands over my face. "Kids get lost in here a lot," she said, as if to be helpful, and then, calling over to the closest register,
"Pete, where's Lenny?"
"Hold on," Pete said. "I got a price check." "Where's the paging equipment?" Mike Reardon said pleasantly. The girl pointed back toward the booth, and he said, "Use it right now, or I'm going to go in and use it myself."
"Don't have a spaz, mister," she said. "Your wife should have been watching him."
"There's Lenny," Pete called, and Mike turned toward a dark man in white shirt and pants. "Here to serve you, Lenny," said the tag on his shirt. "Please," I said.
"They want me to page for their kid," said the girl. "They can't find him. I told them I couldn't page without you saying so."
"He's 10, I said. "He was supposed to be in the comic aisle, where the cards and magazines are." "Skinny kid?" said Lenny. "Dark hair, green shirt?"
"Yes," I said, knowing the worst, knowing what Lenny would say next, describing the man who'd left with the kid as dark, nice-looking, big through the arms and shoulders, looked like the kid, looked like his dad. And Mike Reardon would want to call the police, and I would want to die right here in the supermarket rather than go home to that apartment alone. Or back to Brooklyn.
I just threw him out on his butt. He's probably still out in the parking lot.
"What?"
Mike Reardon said, but I was already halfway to the doors. The pavement between the store and the parking lot was full of people loading groceries into the back of their cars, but off to one side, where the gum machines and the little automated horse rides stood, Robert was sitting on the ground, his arms held tight around his knees, his head down as though he was one of those little black bugs, the ones that roll up into a ball to protect themselves when they're disturbed. I ran to him, touched his arm, and he jumped, then jumped at me, almost knocked me down as he threw his arms around me. Neither of us spoke, and I just held him tight, saying nothing, trying to stop the shaking in his back and shoulders. Then I heard a voice behind me say, "Hi, Robert, you okay?" But Robert shook his head and kept it pressed to the front of my body, although his arms had fallen to his sides. "That bastard, excuse my French, says he thought Robert was alone and that they have a rule against unsupervised kids in the store," Mike Reardon said from behind me. "Apparently they've had some problems with vandalism, shoplifting, and he just throws kids out if they're by themselves." Robert's head snapped up, and spit flew from his mouth as he cried, "I told him and told him that my mom was there and I could find her. I told him I wasn't unsupervised. He just kept saying, 'Sure, sure, she'll find you outside.' He wouldn't listen to me." "Oh, sweetie," I said, holding him tight, but he pulled away.
"He wouldn't even let me look for you. I told him where you were, and then you weren't there. Where did you go? Where did you go?"
He was so loud now that an elderly man came over to peer at him, at us, as though to save him from being abducted by the woman in the faded blue shorts and white polo shirt, the man in the blue button-down and the aviator glasses. "He's fine. He's fine. He's just upset," Mike said.
"I told him," Robert said, crying.
And I reached for him again, but he pushed me away. He slumped back against the big glass window at the front of the supermarket.
I told that guy I'd be writing to the head of the supermarket chain, Mike Reardon said. That was the most stupid, sadistic thing I've ever seen. All he had to do was walk him around the market.
Robert mumbled something, and I leaned in to listen.
I don't care what you said, he said. I told him that my dad would kill him. I told him that he'd shoot him with his gun.
Let's go home, I said. I'll drive you, Mike Reardon said. That night, Robert and I had frozen pizza for dinner. We'd left all our groceries in the store. So had Mike Reardon. I hate this place, Robert said, and I did not reply. I was frightened then, and no amount of paint, no optimistic plans, no hours in the school library, no TYs from Jennifer, nor sit, Mrs. Nurse, from Mrs. Levitt, could take that feeling away. No framed prints hung between the windows could change the fact that the blinds were drawn, sullen and mute. That moment in the supermarket, when I was certain Robert was gone, saw only emptiness in the space where he had been, was like a dress rehearsal for disaster. Afterward, adrenaline was always in my blood, as though I swallowed it down every morning with my vitamins. It was like those times years ago when I went to police funerals with Bobby and felt, as the sound of taps floated over the cemetery, as though I was rehearsing the agony of losing him. It was the greatest pain I could imagine. But I was young then. Coastal storms blew across the state all through the end of October, and the dried and yellowed branches of palms would slither across the roof over my bedroom, sometimes late into the night, the wind blowing gravel from the center courtyard with a sound like bullets spraying the brick walls outside. The storm windows shook in their frames, and I lay on my back staring at the ceiling, waiting for the surreptitious sound of the front door opening. I went over it every night in my mind, how it might have been different, how I could have saved us all, me and Robert and Bobby, too. Sometimes I'd lull myself to sleep with memories of the two of us pushing Robert in his stroller around the neighborhood, Bobby's brawny arm brushing against my own, the hair rising on both, his black and thick, mine pale and downy. Or I'd see Bobby in my mind in the backyard in September, picking tomatoes, looking at each one carefully before he put it into a colander Robert was holding solemnly, proudly at chest level, as though he was a little acolyte, a backyard altar boy. I guess it told me everything I needed to know about my past life, that I'd lie in bed crying while those pictures passed before my mind's eye, feeling the ordinary soft sweetness of those summer days. And yet listening, at the same time, for the noise of someone coming into the apartment to get me, to push me around, to punch me out, to take me out. I was lonely for that other Bobby, the one who whispered in my ear in bed so he wouldn't wake the boy, who sometimes held his hand over my mouth so I wouldn't make too much noise when he was on top of me. "You'll scare the kid, Fran," he'd say close to my ear, and I could tell by the sound of his voice that he liked that he made me squirm and scream that way. But he made me scream those other ways, too, or at least moan and cry, "Please, no." That was my marriage. Please, yes, sometimes. Please, no, the others. If only I could have stayed with one Bobby and left the other. "You had no choice," I said over and over to myself. Sometimes I said it out loud in the little box of a bedroom. After that day in the supermarket, Robert was scared, too. I could tell by the way he behaved in the daylight, truculent and distant, when he'd kick a book across the floor or sit alone in his room, staring at the yellow aluminum siding of the house next door. I could tell by the way he behaved at night, trembling and clingy.
He said the bathroom plumbing was keeping him awake, gurgling and burping through the thin wall, and asked if he could sleep in my bed. I wanted to let him so much, if only to have someone I loved next to me to help me sleep, but I knew it wasn't good for him. It reminded me of when he was a baby, when I'd had to let him cry himself to sleep, to teach him not to keep getting up in the middle of the night, to keep him from being so cranky during the day. Bobby held me down the first night when Robert wailed for 20 minutes straight and I wanted to go to him. The next night it was 10 minutes, and the next he fell asleep before I'd even gotten down the hall. I thought about that all the time now, how sometimes you have to do hard things to your kids to do the right thing for them in the long run. But I still felt the way I'd felt that night, ready to give up, give in at a moment's notice. We struck a bargain, Robert and I. We dragged his mattress into my room next to my bed. I draped my arm over the side and held his hand. He slept there for 4 days, then dragged the mattress back. It's easier to heal, I guess, when you're 10. I still hear noises in the night, the plumbing, the wind, the cars, the past. I hurry down the dusty streets of Lake Plata, my walk just this side of a run, and wait for Robert to come home from school every day. Sometimes I hear him out in the courtyard talking to Benny, the two of them fooling around, whacking each other with their sweatshirts, pulling off each other's caps. Sometimes I just hear the slam of a car door when a mother has arranged to drop him off, or when Mr. Reardon has driven some of them home from soccer. "Thank you," I hear Robert call. He is never really late. He knows. "Hi," I say, as he drops his backpack just inside the door. But it's as though now my real life has begun, as though I've shopped and cleaned and tended to other people in a kind of trance. I never felt this way before, when I worked at the hospital and Robert went after school to his grandmother's for an hour or two. But my life was different then, larger. Now it has been whittled away to its essentials. I make certain kinds of foods because Robert likes them. I bake so that he will have nice desserts. The refrigerator is covered with his test papers. I even bought a baby monitor, the kind we once kept by our bed so we could hear the sounds from his crib, so that he would not even whimper without me knowing it. Now I have the receiver under Robert's bed, the monitor under my pillow. Sometimes I can hear him mumbling in his dreams. It puts me to sleep, like the sound of the ocean knowing he is there, knowing that if someone opens his bedroom window, I will hear it. Often I go in and watch as he sleeps the sleep of a 10-year-old, as close to unconsciousness as a healthy human being can be. I know my greatest fear is his fondest wish. Daddy. 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 He loved Bobby as I once had, viscerally, from the gut, with no regard to events. Bobby was just the sort of father that a small boy would be likely to love. "Does your dad have a gun?" his friends could ask, and he could nod, safe and secure. Once, in second grade, he wrote a story about what we did, Bobby and I. The first sentence was, "My daddy makes sure bad things never happen." The copy of One Fish, Two Fish we'd brought from home sat on Robert's bedside table, and sometimes he read it, although once or twice he said he was going to give it to Chad Rohrbacher. The fish looked so friendly and familiar, smiling up from the page, their cowlicks splayed, their fins akimbo. One night Robert was paging through it and said, "Remember when I was 5 and you used to lie down next to me on the bed while I fell asleep?" I was sorry later, standing by his bed, looking down at him, that I hadn't said or done more. Next night, I slid out of my rubber flip-flops and lay down next to Robert, smiling, my arm over his chest. "Mom, no offense, okay?" he said, "but I'm a little too big for this." But before he went to sleep, he would always suffer me to sit by the side of his bed, and he would ask me questions about my childhood, about whether I liked sharing a room with Aunt Grace, about whether it was scary to be home alone while my mother worked, about my father's job as a fireman and the big fires in which he'd been involved, as though he was constructing from the ground up a life he'd loved and lost, a life I'd seemingly obliterated in one trip. He particularly liked the one about the time a man with a gun had robbed the bakery on a Sunday morning when I was 16, in the desultory fallow period between the 9 and 10:30 masses, when I usually rearranged the donut trays and wiped down the glass cases. "You're kidding, right?" I'd said when he asked for the cash. And after I'd filled a brown bag with bills, he'd demanded donuts, cream-filled, chocolate-frosted. "I'm not giving anybody pastry who just robbed the place," I'd said. And then Mr. Orlovsky from down the block had come in for his Sunday morning seedless rye, and the man had turned and run from the counter, clutching the bag and the gun, knocking Mr. Orlovsky down. "Tell the donut story," Robert said. And then, after, "That was cool. That was brave."
"Jesus God, what a stupid thing to do," Bobby had said on our second date when I told him the story.
"Tell the donut story," Robert said. "I told it to Benny. He thought I made it up."
"I would have given him Kaiser rolls," I said, "but not pastry."
"Tell it from the beginning." He played with my hands, with my fingers, as I told it again. The register, the bills falling into the bag like play money, the sound of the bell on the door as Mr. Orlovsky came inside. Each night, as I stood to go downstairs, he would ask one question. "Does Grandmom know where we are? Does Aunt Grace know where we are? Does Mrs. Selleck, the third grade teacher, or Father Charles, who gave him his first communion, or Mrs. Pinto?" And over I would say no. "No, honey, no, Ba." Until finally one night he told me he didn't want to be called Ba anymore, if I didn't mind, if it didn't hurt my feelings, no offense. But he was too old now. He never asked, "Does Daddy know where we are?" He knew that was the point. I'd sent Grace that note with the photographs because I hadn't wanted her to file a missing persons report. But I was as sure of anything that Bobby would never do that. Would know that the guys in the missing persons section almost always found a missing spouse healthier, happier, somewhere else. He would never countenance the whispers around the force. "You know Benedetto, the guy in narcotics? His wife took off on him, man. Took his kid, too." Why had I been frightened of that young flat-faced cop at the door of the elementary school that first morning? There would be no outside interference. If Bobby came, it would be on his own, slithering over the roof like a big palm frond in a high wind. But I'd be ready for him. Mr. Castro had a tangle of tools in the closet just inside the door of the Castro apartment, and one day I'd asked to borrow his crowbar, and hadn't given it back. It was under my bed. No matter when I touched it, it was always cold, like a dead thing beneath me. Robert allowed himself to be looked after now, to be babied, in his father's words. It was as though the supermarket had given him a taste of something, an inkling of terror and of loss. Our nighttime conversations were the ones he'd had when he was a smaller boy, with less scar tissue. "What if," I said at breakfast, and he said softly, sweetly, "we went to the beach, and you had a really big boogie board, and got good enough at riding the waves that I could stand up like a surfer, and dolphins swam up to shore and swam around you, and I could understand what they were saying." "Yo, Robert," Benny yelled from outside in the dusty quadrangle. "The bus is coming." "We'll go to the beach soon," I said as I kissed Robert goodbye. "I promise." It wasn't really goodbye at all, only see you soon. For every morning I followed the bus route on foot, met up with Cindy just as I had that first day. She usually brought me something, a jar of collagen cream, a crock of genuine Vermont maple syrup, tomatoes from her parents' farm.
"Oh, please," she'd say dismissively when I tried to thank her. It was easier to thank her obliquely. "I love that perfume," I'd say, or "that's a good color on you," and she'd smile. Her teeth overlapped in the front, and she always smiled with her mouth closed, unless she was having a really good time, and then she forgot.
"What's in the bag?" she said the Monday morning after the supermarket, and I pulled out a jar of my red sauce, what Bobby's family always called gravy.
"Bless you," she said. "I'll just dump it over some ziti tonight."
"If my mother-in-law could hear the way you say ziti, she'd have a stroke," I said.
"She's your ex-mother-in-law, hun, so who cares?" said Cindy. "She Italian?"
"She's a witch," I said.
"That's nice. What else you got in there?"
"Running shoes," I said.
"Oh, please," Cindy said.
That's really how I got to know Mike Reardon, by running 3 mornings a week, the mornings after the library that I didn't have coffee and muffins at Cindy's house. It had come to me suddenly, as I was trying to make things normal, ordinary, better, as I was laying shelf paper in the slightly sticky kitchen cabinets. It had come to me again as I rose from bed after those nights awake, listening when my body would feel stiff and old. It had come to me finally in Kmart, buying white crepe-soled shoes to wear to work, stopping in front of cheap running shoes and remembering the expensive pair Grace had given me for my 27th birthday, white nylon mesh with turquoise and purple stripes and a bubble of some gold gel in the heel. "Running makes you feel young again," Grace had said.
"To hell with you," I'd said. "I still am young."
I couldn't think of Gracie too much now. It made it too hard, harder than it was any other time. But when I was running those first few months in Brooklyn, when I was 27 and trying to get pregnant, and she was 21 and trying to get into grad school, I thought of her every time I ran. I always imagined her making a loop around Riverside Park as I made an arc around the bayfront in Brooklyn. "I'm running with you in my mind," I said, when we talked about our best times and our injuries, our knees and our hamstrings. I worked the 8-to-4 shift at South Bay, and I'd get up at 6 and run in the morning, when the air felt as though someone had just blown it out into the Brooklyn streets, like it had been delivered fresh each morning the way they used to deliver our milk in those smooth glass bottles when I was little. The lights were on in some houses when I went out, the cars steaming in the driveways in wintertime, a few people already on their way to the bus stop. But the streets were quiet except for the thud of my running shoes on the pavement in a perfect rhythm that made me feel that living through any day was possible. 2, sometimes 3 miles, the sun coming up over the bay, painting a streak of silver across the undulating water, making me squint and stagger until I'd turn away from dead east into the narrow streets running north. I'd watch them run the marathon on television, and at the start it looked more like rush hour on the IRT than running, all of them jockeying for a square foot of pavement across the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. I never ran like that. I liked being alone. Bobby had worked evenings and nights a lot.
"It's when the bad guys work, so it's when I have to work too," he told Robert later on, when the boy was old enough to understand.
So I'd do my day shift, go to bed early, run just after or just before daybreak, depending on the seasons, and come in and take a shower as quietly as I could manage, carrying my shoes out into the hallway so the sound of them on the floor would not disturb him. On the kitchen counter would be the dirty plate from Bobby's dinner the night before that I always left on a warm setting in the oven. Aunt Benedetto hadn't raised her son to get his own meals or wash his own dishes. I stopped running when I was 6 months pregnant with Robert and started again when he was a year old and I went back to work. Bobby didn't want me to do either one, said we didn't need the money and I didn't need the exercise. But I worked part-time on a night shift for a couple of years, so that I was mostly at the hospital when Robert was asleep and once he started school, I was gone only when he was.
But that 1 hour in the morning was for me. In the dark, in the dining room, I laced on my shoes, pulled on my sweatshirt, pounded the pavement until my throat burned with the effort of breathing. I even ran once with 2 broken ribs, just to show Bobby what I was made of.
"Franny, Franny, Fran," he mumbled that morning as I stripped off my shorts, the bed smelling of sweat and scotch and semen, because he never wanted me more than when I was broken and bruised.
"You are one fucking piece of work."
I ran in Lake Plata after I got home from school in the morning, making a circuit of the blocks around the apartment complex. Poinsettia, Hibiscus, Royalton, Largo, Miramar. The musical words that danced attendance on the flat frame houses with the attached garages. The heat was like a sock stuffed in your throat, and sweat ran from me like tears, tickling and taunting my legs and chest and arms. I left my wire-rimmed glasses on the battered chest in the bedroom, and the sun made fluorescent spots in front of me and waves of black at the periphery of my vision. Sometimes, despite myself, I'd see Brooklyn in my mind, and it was as though if I ran hard and fast enough, I'd come around the corner and I'd be home, really home, up the street from the bay in Brooklyn. The towels would be soft on my body and the carpeting soft under my feet, and Robert would be wandering around half asleep, dogged by little boy problems, lost shoes, misplaced homework. And Bobby would be where? Somewhere else. We'd have the idea of Bobby in the house, as though any moment he might walk in. It would be like perfume, like the smell of gravy cooking on Sunday or the turkey on Thanksgiving. So sweet, the smell of safety. I could almost smell it over the smell of gasoline and petunias on the back streets of Lake Plata. Sometimes I cried as I ran, but it was so hot and I looked so rattled that you couldn't even tell. There was no one to see, anyhow. Everyone was inside or at work. One morning, there was a man standing at the corner of Largo and Miramar, leaning against the corner of a chain-link fence behind which a dog reared, snapped, snarled, filled with frustration at my flashing legs just out of his reach. By the front gate was a sign, "Beware of the dog," it said. It seemed so completely superfluous that I almost laughed. The man nodded at me. His arms were folded across his chest, red as summer roses from the heat. For a week I ran around the streets, different routes on different days, with certain landmarks to guide me. A trailer painted turquoise as bright as a postcard of the Caribbean. A white house with a black cat always unflappably sitting in one window. A lawn with a bumper crop of yellow plastic sunflowers with whirligig petals, occasionally stirred to a desultory turn in the still mid-morning air. Once again I saw the man. This time he was reading a paper, standing at the same corner, and he didn't look up as I passed on the other side of the street. The third time I came upon him, I was coming from the opposite direction, thumped around the corner, and he was sitting in a parked car, a battered white sedan. It was near the end of my run, and I was tired, had gone a good distance, 4, maybe 5 miles. The sidewalk was cracked and heaved up just at the curb line, a nosegay of dried and dying dandelions growing where the earth beneath the concrete showed pebbly and brown. I stumbled, nearly went down, righted myself and felt a pain in my ankle, tried to continue quickly past him, saw him looking at me, noticed all at once his thick arms and chest, his odd, disconnected half-smile, the way he seemed glad to see me as he leaned toward the open window. The dog was hurling itself at us both from behind the fence, and I wondered how I could have been foolish enough to assume them connected, man and animal. I was hemmed in by the car and the fence, and I moved past him, and yet waited, in my mind, to feel his hands. Maybe he muttered something, I don't know. But as I edged past him, I ran faster, faster than I'd ever run before, all the way home.
locked the doors, checked the windows for the 1,000th time, changed without showering, because I was afraid that the sound of the water would mute the sound of someone coming in the window or the door, though they were locked. Locked tight. What did they matter, locks? Once in the emergency room, the cops brought in a woman who'd had to be carried naked from a building the city was demolishing. Wrapped in a blanket, her head tucked between her shoulders like a dying bird, she'd huddled in the corner of the examining room, and I'd asked her what she was afraid of. Her whisper was so soft that at first I didn't hear her. "Everything," she finally said a little louder. It shamed me now to remember that I'd gone out to the nurse's station and said, under my breath, "What a head case this one is." It shamed me, now that I was afraid of everything myself. I'd never found out, after they took her up to psych, whether that woman had good reason to be afraid. The next week I didn't run. I told myself it was the ankle. "It's a filthy habit, anyhow," Cindy said. "Get yourself one of those Jane Fonda tapes." But one day I wore shorts, a t-shirt, and my shoes to school in the morning, and after Cindy had driven to pick up Chad from her mother and take him to tumbling class, I'd made a slow circuit of the track that sat gray, brown, and sunburned between the elementary school and the big sprawling middle school a block away. It was boring, that sort of running. No store windows to offer color and light. No good morning from mailmen with their breath running in a stream of steam from between chapped lips. But from the track, I could see the front and back entrances to the school and the drive leading up to both. From the track, I could see Robert and Benny and the other boys who had begun to gather in a group around them shoot hoops on the blacktop during morning recess. If I could have run all day instead of working, I would have. Mike Reardon fell into step beside me the third morning I was out there. He was wearing an Orlando Magic t-shirt and baggy running shorts. You can tell a lot by someone's running clothes. If the colors are bright, the fit fine, the logo's designer, it almost always means fraud, someone who likes the idea of running better than the act itself. Mike Reardon's shorts and shirt looked ancient, one step removed from the rummage sale. The real deal. "Okay if I join you?" he said. And I nodded, no words, because I was already breathing hard, the way I like to, so that I felt really alive. For the next 30 minutes, we said nothing at all, until as we were pulling up, panting, cramping, he added, "I have a free period now, and this beats evenings all to hell." Neither of us were chatty runners. Both of us could go for almost an hour without giving up. Or maybe he slowed down for me, or maybe I picked up for him. My fears cooled as my flushed face did, walking home to shower and change into my blue polyester uniform shift to make my rounds. But at night, I still set a folding chair beneath Robert's window piled with boys' stuff, video games and books and little bits of leftover Lego things he and Benny worked on, things that would fall to the floor with a clatter if anyone came through the window. I used Mike Reardon those early days. I felt safer with him around, and I was unapologetic, unashamed about using him for protection, even though he had no idea I needed protecting, no idea that he was any more than my running partner. I'd never run with someone else before, and I was startled by the spurious and instantaneous intimacy it produced, the sound of the two of us breathing hard, ragged, in tandem, half-dressed, single-minded, perspiring, and without the usual scrim of carefully arranged hair, polite smiles, makeup, and sunglasses. When I left school after my run, knowing that no stranger had entered the front office or peered through the chain link of the playground fence, I left also knowing that no one could easily have contact with or news of Robert with Mr. Reardon standing guard. I remembered how he'd bellowed at the manager of the supermarket, and I felt less afraid for my son. "He's sweet on you," Cindy said. "That's all I'm saying.
That's it. He is.
Oh, please, I said. He's a friend, a male friend. Women have male friends.
Well, now, dear heart, that's fine, except that if the good Lord had wanted women to have male friends, he would have arranged for men and women to have something in common.
You don't have men friends?
I have a husband. He sort of has friends. They're sort of my friends. You know the name of that tune.
I'd had a man friend once, or thought I had. Sometimes Ben Samuels and I ate lunch in the pale green cafeteria at the hospital, where everyone looked ill, in the watery light from the glass block windows. Once we went to a conference on trauma treatment in Manhattan, in the auditorium of the medical center where he'd gone to med school. And afterward he took me to a Japanese restaurant for dinner, where we sat on tatami mats, our shoes side by side at the sliding paper door, a pair of brown suede lace-ups, a pair of navy pumps. There was something about those empty shoes that suggested an indiscretion, but all we'd done was eat teriyaki and talk, of nothing really, although both of us spoke a little more effusively than need be of our family lives. Over tea, he was surprised that I'd missed the piece in the Sunday Times about head injuries, more surprised when I said I didn't read the paper. I can't believe a woman as smart as you can get through the day without the New York Times, he said. And I'd blushed and been embarrassed and replied in a flippant voice, "Cops hate the Times. They think it always takes the side of the bad guys. Cops spit on the New York Times. The news is the cop paper."
"But you're not a cop," he said. I've never forgotten the way he said that. It came back to me, even after he'd moved out west.
"That's a good move for him," Winnie said when she heard about it, giving me a look. I know Winnie thought I used Ben Samuels to get some of what I didn't get at home, someone to talk to, someone who took me seriously. I'd been happy in his friendship. But happiness wasn't what I got from Mike Reardon's company. He made me feel safe, safer than I'd felt in a long time. And it made me feel safer having Robert at school with Mike there. Sometimes I think Mike sensed all that, without understanding exactly why, as he ran alongside me, stood on the sidelines in front of me at soccer games. The first time I watched Robert zigzagging across the flat expanse of the school soccer field, all I could think of, all I could watch, was the stand of trees at one end. All I could think of was a familiar figure emerging from behind one of the tree trunks as everyone was staring the other way, downfield at the visitor's goal, of someone reaching out for the Lake Plata school forward with the floppy bangs and skinny legs. The quick kid who called instructions to his teammates in a surprisingly low voice as his feet churned up the turf. Bobby, motioning to Robert, "Come on. Come here." Blink and he'd be gone, my son, floating off like a piece of ashy paper lifted from the fire by a wind up the chimney on a cold night. It was all I could do not to pull him off the sidelines when another boy went in his place. And I think, turning and seeing me, knowing just what I looked like when I was terrified, Mike Reardon knew some of what I was feeling. "I need a parent to go with us on the bus to Lakota Tuesday," he said one day after we'd lost a home game 3-1. "I'll be there," I said. I'd never known a teacher to talk to, except for Grace, if an associate professor of American Studies could be called a teacher. All those years of school with the nuns, grade school, high school, even nursing school, the cool remove of their habits and instant bar to intimacy that remained when the black veils and white wimples gave way to street clothes and nurses' uniforms. Even the teachers at St. Stanley's had intimidated me, standing at the heavy school door and shutting it with a thunk when the last of the identically dressed children had hurried inside. I gave them my son, and twice a year they gave me a progress report. Mediocre penmanship, decent spelling, an affinity for math and history, a good boy. So for weeks I did what the kids did, called him Mr. Reardon, silly as it was, he 5 years younger than I, with that pink baby face and straw-colored baby hair. But it seemed to suit the circumstances.
Mr. Reardon dropping Robert off after soccer practice and accepting a Pepsi at the kitchen table while he and Robert complained about the ref they'd had for the last game. Mr. Reardon taking Robert, Benny, and two other boys to McDonald's to reward them for perfect attendance at the end of the first month of intramural practice and play. Mr. Reardon taking Robert and me to the International House of Pancakes after a Saturday morning game at which Robert had scored two goals.
"Let me say this," he'd said, bent over blueberry pancakes and bacon, wearing his yellow polo shirt with Mike embroidered over the heart. "You came to play today," he pointed his fork at Robert. "You came to play and did. That second goal was a miracle."
"You looked good out there," I said, smiling.
"You looked great," Mr. Reardon said.
Mr. Reardon, the two of us sitting on the leatherette seats at the front of the bus, our conversation interrupted by the throwing of paper and the occasional muttered asshole from the seats behind.
"Keep it clean, guys," Mr. Reardon yelled. "Keep it clean."
It's hard to call a teacher by his first name. Maybe that was when I started to call him Mike, on the bus. One day he had a lottery ticket in his top pocket, and when I mentioned it, he blushed.
"I buy one every once in a while," he said, turning it over in his hands. "You know, you pick up the paper, some gum, then you give the man a couple of numbers."
He read them off the ticket. 19, 9, 44, 10, 21.
"I don't even know how I picked these," he said.
"What would you do if you won? Would you quit your job?"
He shook his head.
"Nah. Look at me. I play soccer with 10-year-olds for pay. Why would I quit?" I laughed.
"Mr. Reardon, Sean called me a Tampax," a boy named Andrew shouted from the back.
"Hold on," Mr. Reardon said, and walked to the back of the bus.
I looked back, pretending I was watching the mediation, when what I was really looking for was Robert, the sheer pleasure of seeing him sitting quiet, maybe even content, near the back of the bus. He was staring out the window while Benny talked to him about something. His profile looked hard, adult. He glanced up, saw me, waved. Mr. Reardon stopped by to talk to the two of them for a moment, and they looked up at him, tipping their heads back on the slender straws of their necks, tipping them far back as though Mr. Reardon was a giant or God.
"He's doing it again," Andrew called.
There was silence, then more bickering, then the rumble of a deeper voice, then silence again. "You Tampax," I said, when he dropped back into his seat. "I know," he said. "I do all the disciplinary stuff, and one of my biggest problems is not laughing. One of the third-grade girls came in crying the other day. I sit her down, I give her a Kleenex. She's sniffing and blowing her nose, and finally she says, 'Joshua keeps telling me he loves me, and I just want him to stop.'"
"That is a great job," I said.
"I guess most people would quit, if they won the lottery, I mean."
"I wouldn't. I love to work. My mother always worked. When I was a kid, it was my father who didn't work. It was like a life sentence, guilty of emphysema. Sentenced to the big chair in front of the TV for the rest of his life. The poor guy was like a piece of furniture. I never wanted to be like that. I had my first job when I was 16.
"My mother never worked."
"How many kids did she have?"
"7.
"She worked," I said.
Out the windows of the bus, the sun was sinking behind a grove of trees and a row of shacks the migrants used when they came to Florida to pick fruit. A stray dog chased after our tires, and the noise of the boys began to evaporate with the daylight, their conversation to go gray with fatigue. They'd lost 4-2 in a tough game. Robert had played poorly. "How's your hamstring?" Mr. Reardon said.
"Still sore."
"You should stay off it."
"Ha,"
I said. I'll be out there tomorrow morning.
I had Robert in my office the other day, Mr. Reardon said quietly. I kept meaning to tell you.
Why?
He got into some kind of argument with two of the boys. Apparently they were teasing him about the way he looks, how dark he is or something. You know how they are at this age. And he held one of them against the wall and said, I'm going to get you. Mrs. Burnson was just a little knocked out by the way he said it, like he really meant it, if you know what I mean. I knew exactly what he meant. I closed my eyes and leaned against the window. Robert the Hobbit, Robert the Hobbit, making sure that no one got over on him, just as Daddy said. It was Bobby Benedetto's song, the one he sang as he paced his kitchen. I'm gonna get that sucker who sells crack in the quad at the Lincoln Projects. I'm gonna get that asshole who laughed at us when we stopped him the other day. I'm gonna get the jerk-off who threw the tennis ball at the patrol car, opened the hydrant, put his little brother out to work as a drug runner. Getting them all. That was Bobby Benedetto's vocation.
Hey, Mike Reardon said, it's no big deal. We talked. Or I talked, and he listened. You know, he's basically a good kid. He has some problems dealing with anger. And other stuff. I think he keeps things bottled up inside.
I know, I said. The divorce, I said, the move, the new school, the new friends. He would be fine.
Fine.
Fine, fine.
Sometimes you say a word so many times that it loses its meaning and shape in your mouth, until it's like a piece of gristly meat and you want to spit it out or swallow and get it over with.
Fine. First Robert said it, now I did. If we said everything was fine often enough, maybe it would be true.
Even Mr. Reardon did it. One day as we were running, trickles of sweat outlining the curve of both our jaws, our breath coming hard and jagged, he suddenly said, softly, then more insistently, "Don't worry about him too much. Don't worry, he's fine."
But of course he had no idea.
"He's fine," I said again.
"I know that," he said. "I do think it would do him some good to talk to somebody, Dr. Stern, maybe." What could I say? There was no kid in the world who needed to talk to someone, as people always delicately said when they wanted you to see a shrink. I knew. I'd done it in the ER dozens of times myself. There was no kid who needed it more than Robert. There was no one who needed more to speak the words he couldn't say, to look at the things he couldn't see. Someday, I swore, I'd do that for him, so that he could give up the secret once and for all, so that he could say that his father had lied to him, and his mother too, all those mornings when they acted as though everything was all right.
Fine. Fine. But not now.
That was Robert Benedetto's story. And for now, no matter how bad it was for us both, Robert had to be Robert Crenshaw.
"I'll think about it," I finally said. "I really will. I know he needs to get things out of his system more."
He might do better if a professional could help him with that. It might give him some ways to deal that would make him feel better.
"I know. I'm just not sure it's the right time."
"Well, think about it."
"I will. And promise you'll tell me if anything else happens, or if you notice any kind of problem. I need to know.